stopping it, we've already seen the damage done. The question is a true reversal to the status quo before Lou DeJoy became the Postmaster General this summer.
Lisa Graves, we want to thank you so much for being with us. And we have to stop saying November is the election, because people who vote by mail are voting in the next weeks, and that goes on for more than a month. Lisa Graves, executive director of the policy research group True North, with a new report we'll link to, The Billionaire Behind Efforts to Kill the U.S. Postal Service. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome to this week's Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamrani, and today we bring you the story of Paul Soak. This piece comes to us from the Rework podcast from the UCLA Labor Center, and we wanted to air this piece because it highlights so many of the issues we care about here at Making Contact, namely the school-to-prison pipeline and the vulnerability of immigrants as they face deportation. Here's Rework and their piece, No Child Left Behind.
I'm a product of violence. I'm a product of state violence.
of the violence that's perpetuated by American policies.
From the UCLA Labor Center in KPFK, this is Rework. I'm Sabah Wahid.
And I'm Veena Humpapour. What comes to mind when you hear the word teenager? Juvenile. Child. To quote Whitney Houston, we often believe that children are our future, a symbol of hope for a better tomorrow. We see them as innocents who need love, support, and stability. But not all young people are nurtured this way. Too often, youth from marginalized communities of color are not seen as needing protection. They are treated as the ones we need protection from.
We see this in today's episode with Paul Soak, who was once a kid in Long Beach forced to grow up too soon. This episode is part two of our series on Cambodian refugees who get caught up in the criminal justice system at a young age.
My name is Paul Soak. I'm Cambodian by ethnicity, but born in the Thai refugee camps. My dad and my brother were living in Cambodia during the time of the Vietnam War. But after the Khmer Rouge took power, my dad and my brother wound up in forced labor camps, re-education camps. They had seen a lot of different things happen. You know, just a lot of murders and torture, crimes against humanity, things of that magnitude.
During the Vietnam War, the U.S. enacted a brutal bombing campaign against Cambodia. Fearing for their lives, tens of thousands of civilians fled to Thailand, including Paul's father and 18-year-old brother.
He just ended up in the UN camps, and that is where my dad and my mom actually met. If we look at it from that perspective, if not for the war, I would not be born. I was born after they have already been approved for asylee status in the United States. My family went into a staging camp for where you would travel out, and so I was born there. 61 days later, we were in LAX. And so that's when I arrived to the U.S. as a child of a refugee. A family unit was me, my mom, my dad, and my brother.
The transition to life in Southern California in the 80s just wasn't that easy.
My parents ended up divorcing due to a lot of the issues of just trying to adapt to a new environment. Shortly after the divorce, we ended up moving. My dad felt very uncomfortable in L.A. He said there weren't a lot of Cambodians. And then he found that there were pockets of Cambodians that had settled in Long Beach.
Paul's family was part of a migration of refugees that moved to lower-income neighborhoods in Long Beach. Today, Long Beach is home to the largest Cambodian population in the country.
My dad felt more comfortable with neighbors that were Cambodian, that he can go knock on a door and ask for something. Hey, I need some sugar. When I needed something or times of need or whatever when I was younger, it was always folks from the Cambodian community that were there. I do remember first day of school, nobody walks you or anything. You just follow the line, just try to figure out where you're going. And I remember starting to cry. I was 5 years old and all kinds of white students walked by. Nobody did anything. Then there was an older Cambodian student. She came through. She was the first one to grab my hand and figured out where I was supposed to be at. Stuff like that kind of left a mark on me, made me more comfortable being around other Cambodians. The embrace from a white community or a black community or a brown community just wasn't there.
Paul's father worked long hours to provide financially, and his older brother had moved out. As a child, Paul had to learn how to take care of himself.
From the age of, 7 or 8, I was basically coming home to nobody. And so I had to learn how to cook, I had to learn how to feed myself. And I always used to wonder where my dad was. But then he was I'm out just trying to make money. When he was in the camps, he had been beaten in the back with some rifles and stuff like that. So he had a lot of injuries, physical trauma amongst, emotional trauma, et cetera. What type of meaningful, sustaining labor is there for folks like that? And so he would do manual labor, whatever he could do. He used to go out, collect cans, and recycle as a means of income. My dad never drove, so I was always using public transit, or you'd find a shopping cart to use. Those were my earliest memories of my dad.
Neighborhood violence became a concern as Paul approached his teen years.
I want to say there was a lot of violence within the communities. It came to a situation where, I literally only walked a couple of miles back and forth between home and school. But some of my friends only walked about a mile, and some of my friends never made it home. That was the type of violence that was brewing inside the communities. In my teenage years, it became more of cops drawing down on us and pointing guns at us, telling us to get up on the wall and, you know, searching us and things like that, going through our backpack. It was, became more of a regular occurrence. It was just us in the neighborhoods, just hanging out like in the front yard where we knew we'd be safe. And sometimes the helicopters would be coming by, and the next thing you know, here comes police showing up, like blocking off both sides of the street, and then just finding everybody that's young, that's Asian, and telling us all to sit on the curb. Sometimes it's 5 or 6 of us, sometimes it's 10 or 12 of us.
Paul and his friends were not being protected from danger. They were being treated like they were the danger.
For a lot of us growing up, we didn't have a lot of money, so a lot of our clothes were hand-me-downs, and so it would look baggy. And, you know, out there, like a young person walk around in baggy clothing, you know, you're getting profiled as a certain way. It didn't matter if your backpack was full of books, you know, you're just walking home, and that's all they saw. They were putting us on cop cars, on top of the hood. Sometimes it would get really bad. There were instances where people were being put in the back of a police car, not even being arrested or anything, and then the cop car would drop them off in the alley somewhere and just, like, tell them to get out of the car, and the cop car would drive off, leaving these people in danger. And this became more and more frequent.
Policing youth of color was nothing new. But what changed in the 1990s was that politicians and media fostered a sense of crisis. This contributed to surveilling and criminalizing low-level offenses that had not been punished in the past.
They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel. And the president has asked the FBI to launch a very concerted effort against gangs everywhere.
The systems used minor infractions to build criminal records, pushing youth into the criminal justice system even before a serious crime was committed. When it came to youth from marginalized communities, punishment trumped care.
Because they're always asking, hey, who are you? What's your name? Where do you live? What's your address? And so it leads me to assume, like, all of us at some point got put into a gang database. There wasn't any opportunity to really process those interactions. We just kind of had to deal with them, just accept them for what they were. If I wanted to go tell my brother about it, he'd be like, well, what did you do wrong? You know, if I went and told my dad about it, he'd be like, well, what did you do wrong? If we went to the school and we said it, you know, and then the school would just kind of look at us sideways. And so when we have these encounters with law enforcement, you know, all the adults around us are thinking we did something wrong. I kind of felt secluded. They never saw these encounters for what they were. And so I had to just, like, kind of suck it up. As a young person, it's very, like, traumatizing. It carried through with me as I got a little bit older, too.
Then, in high school, Paul's father became ill.
I had to rush home, or I had to find a means of somebody to drive me home because he needed daily care. I would come home from school, go get the heparin, had to go get a syringe, had to go check his longevity in his feeding bag, make sure the machine was running, no alarms or anything like that, check his weight, make sure his catheter was clean, etc., right? And making sure the supplies were there. Kept me secluded, kept me isolated. And not really having anybody else to hang out with. I didn't have any siblings that were my age. I didn't have any peers.
Paul took care of his dad this way for over a year. One day, he got a call from the hospital.
My dad had passed away. Some of the last words from him weren't the greatest of words to me. Kind of yelled at me, blamed me for being sick, stuff like that. So I had to process all of that real fast, or try to process it and deal with losing him.
Paul was just 16 years old, and now he was completely on his own.
Nobody came to check up on me. Nobody from social services showed up. There wasn't a youth center I could go to. There wasn't a grief counselor. You know, I would have walked 2-3 miles to see somebody say, hey, what do I do now? The only thing I got was a pamphlet from the hospital that said, hey, this is grief. I read it, didn't understand it, had never dealt with grief before, so I didn't know what grief was. I needed somebody to, like, tell me, give me that understanding. I went to school and I was like, my dad just died. And the teachers were like, oh, that sucks. But it wasn't like, oh, wait, hold on. Really? Like, who are you living with? Like, who's taking care of you now?
Paul had been an engaged student with a knack for electronics.
It was just like a natural skill or aptitude I have. My dad would just buy me, like, soldering iron, solder, and just give me stuff. Like, I would find broken stuff. Or in some cases, I would have working stuff and I would break it to try to learn how it worked. I was enrolled in Pauley High School, but I was also enrolled in a Cal State program. It was a dual program. So I was getting Cal State credits while I was working towards my high school diploma at the same time. And so it was a program that was set up for me to be able to get into the field of electrical engineering to like really go in that route.
His father's death started to impact his education. He was struggling, even in the Cal State program he loved.
I tried to stay focused and try to do some schoolwork and try to maintain the Cal State program. And the only reason, too, is because when I was withdrawing, the professor was like, look, there's something unique about you. You have a talent, you have a skill. He pulled out this dot chart, and there was one that was way above everybody else, and said, that dot is you. That's your score, even though you've missed every single assignment except for one. There's something about you. You have the ability to like work with this information I'm giving you. He's like, whatever you do, come back to my class. I don't care if you ditch the others, skip the rest, whatever. Just don't miss this class. And so I tried. I tried. It became, you know, more and more difficult as it went by.
Paul realized he needed help, so he reached out to his high school counselor.
So I went to go see the counselor. I said, hey, I'm really struggling. What do we do? While she was eating on a sandwich, she handed me a piece of paper. It says, sign here, turn in your books by the end of the day, and report to this packet school. They didn't say, hey, well, why don't you, wait, hold on, let's talk about this. It was just, here's your slip, sign it, turn it in. And then when I went to the other school, that's when I learned it was just a packet school. They literally copied exercises out of a textbook. The work was like very remedial. They gave me a card, and they said, this card is what you show to law enforcement when you have law enforcement contact. They didn't say if you get stopped, they say when you get stopped by the police. That was like more of an important conversation than the curriculum itself.
The whole system had failed Paul. Social workers, teachers, and counselors, they all missed the chance to provide him with resources. Rather than being a place of nurturing and growth, schools mirrored the surveillance and control he faced in the streets.
Paul struggled coming home to an empty house.
I would walk home and like my dad wasn't there, right? Like nobody was there. And I would just sit being very bummed out, very depressed. And I can only take so much depression, I would just leave the house. And so I just ended up in the streets. And the one thing I found is that the streets embraced me. And they said, you lost your dad, man, we feel you. Let's just hang out, whatever. And so with that embrace, you know, it was like very heartwarming, right? In a sense, it was helpful just to keep me emotionally stable. I would hang out, just trying to cope with forgetting about losing my dad. I hung out and I hung out more and more and more. And with more hanging out, I got involved with thefts and things of that nature, a lot of property crimes and stuff like that. At the age of 17, I ended up being arrested. The arrest was very demeaning. It was like the sun was barely coming up. They put me up against the garage next to my house and they started taking pictures of me handcuffed. Students that I knew in the neighborhood were walking by, elders that were taking their kids to school.
You were just listening to Making Contact, an hour adaptation of a podcast out of the UCLA Labor Center called Rework, and their episode called No Child Left Behind. To find out more about Rework, or to hear more of our podcasts, or get updates on upcoming shows, visit radioproject.org.
I'm speaking now with Marvin Pena, who is with the Workers Education Center, VOES, that is based here in Portland on Martin Luther King Avenue, and provides a space for workers who are day laborers and who are specialists in different fields to be able to get hired on a regular basis. Marvin, thank you for joining us on KBOO.
Yeah, thank you, Jenka, for, you know, the opportunity and being able to, you know, spread the word about the work we're doing and talking a little bit about the event that we have coming, the online event that we have coming for, you know, fundraise, raise money for the work that we're doing with day laborers.
Right. And I know we talked previously about COVID-19 and its impact on day laborers. Now we're a number of months into this thing. How is it impacting your work at VOES and the lives of the workers that come to VOES on a regular basis?
Right. Well, still, I guess nothing have gotten better since we spoke, a couple of months ago. Still, just by this time of the year, I think I mentioned that, but usually somewhere between 40 and 50 workers used to go out to work. Right now, there are days of maybe one or two, six or seven. So not many people are hiring for, you know, many reasons. First, they don't want to spend the money probably, and especially now that the federal, you know, support ran out, and also, you know, the risk of getting sick, or, you know, just the chances of being in contact with people that have been out there. And so there are several elements that have been, you know, affecting the work that we do, but especially the work that they can get from mostly homeowners. In terms of the work we're doing, of course, we shifted completely, and now we're more like a, you know, resource navigation place where we have some of the staff helping with house insecurity, and then we have other part of the staff working on food insecurity. So we're trying to get food to just not give away, but also we do deliveries to those who have a home. And other people, you know, part of the staff, the ED, is working hard and trying to find resources for the work we do in general, like just to keep the place open. And at the same time, we have advocating staff who are advocating for the work we do, so to find more resources. The Oregon, we have been part of that in coalition with other organizations like the Community of Colors. And so we have been working in several fronts, but completely where we were before, as a, like a training place and ESL class, none of that is happening now because of COVID.
Wow. And it must be having such a devastating impact on workers that really have no financial security from day to day. I mean, you say you're providing food support for people. Is that something that listeners could donate to support the workers who are now out of work?
Yeah, we, in our website, there is a link on the top right that it says support workers during COVID. And that is a place to go, and we have a list of things that we usually give away. And so listeners can go there, definitely the PortlandVoz.org. And on the top right corner, we have a link, a tag for these kind of donations. Also, you know, now we're working on the, you'll find the website, we're working on the online fundraising event, and talk a little more about that a little bit, but you can find that on the website as well. Yeah, definitely people can support in any way they can, but the website will be the place to go. Also, we're posting things regularly on social media about what we're doing, what we need, and to keep supporting workers.
And that website, again, is PortlandVoz.org. That's VOZ.org.
Yes.
And
yes.
Another thing that people could do is to actually hire the workers. Can you talk a little about that and what the process is and who can hire a worker from
the local business? Sure, of course. Yeah, that's the most direct way to support the work we do is hiring a worker. And the way that works is you call to our worker center, and you talk to a dispatcher, and then you ask them, you know, the work that you want to get done and all these details. And then on that, then you can the dispatcher, can match you with the right worker. So if you want to do a roofing job, if you want to do a yard work, then we find a worker who has the skills to do that kind of job. So we basically connect you with the workers, and we take a work order so everyone is clear what's going to happen. Just to remind listeners to the number to call, it would be 503-234-2043. Again, that's the Martin Luther King Worker Center, and the phone number is 503-234-2043. 2043. So that's the most, you know, direct way to support workers is hiring them. And we have people who know roofing, you know, drywall. You just call ahead of time and we can arrange that and, you know, make it happen. It takes a little bit more time because of COVID. It has been like, we have a few workers at the work site, but it's, since we have all the restrictions, we don't have as many people within the worker center. So we basically call them to their phones and ask if they're available to work. So it's a little, you know, shifting from what it used to be, but still we are working on finding ways to get them hired.
And what precautions are you taking to ensure the safety of workers and the people who hire the workers?
Sure. We are providing at least with basic PPE. We are giving away a mask, a glove if needed. We have, you know, hand sanitizer and, you know, places where they can wash their hands constantly. When we have people at the worker center, we do our best to enforce the social distancing. And in fact, we have had an assembly of about 8 to 10 workers, and we separate, and, you know, with the 6 feet apart. So we are doing the best we can to provide not just the PPE, but also keeping the social distancing and, of course, cleaning everything, you know, as best as we can in order to protect workers, protect us, and protect employers that have us. So if they don't have a mask for some reason, we provide them with one. You know, just because we have been receiving also donations from people, so we have masks and all that to give away.
And you mentioned that you're having a couple of fundraisers to support the Portland Workers Education Center, VOES. Can you talk about the fundraisers that you have coming up?
Sure. On September 12th, we'll have a Facebook Live where we're going to be auctioning things. We're going to be, you know, telling people how they can support organization, how they can donate. That will be, if you go to Facebook and look on our web, in our profile, sorry, you can find the event. And it'll be live, but it will be happening throughout September the 12th. So we'll have, you know, like slides. We have people talking live. Hopefully we can have a couple of workers telling their story about, you know, how this situation, the pandemic, has been affecting their life and, you know, how VOES has been part of in their, you know, support system, if you will. So that will be happening on September 12th from 10 a.m. to noon. That's going to be the Facebook Live, and hopefully we'll have stuff throughout the day just broadcasting that. And, yeah, the idea is to raise money to not just support workers, but also keep the place open, you know, pay the wages, but also all the bills that we have as an organization, because the danger is, like, if we cannot be there, so quite a few people that, you know, one of the most vulnerable group won't have support in any way. So we have been giving away, at this point, we're over 200, like, food boxes, and that's delivered, and also people who come to the worker center, we give it away. So we give, you know, hot lunches if we can. So all these things that we have support, like if any of them has like a COVID symptoms, we place them in a shelter that deal with that. So we have been working hard to support them how we can. So if we cannot be there, there will be, you know, a huge impact in the workers in general. So we want to be able to keep working and stay open during these times.
Yeah, and so this online auction, you have a Facebook Live event. You said it's September 12th, right?
Yes.
And then you also have an ongoing silent auction?
Yes, and we'll have the day of, we'll be posting in our Facebook event the items, and the day of we'll have a silent auction, more likely people, sending direct messages with the amounts and stuff like that, but at the same time we'll have throughout the day, whatever we cannot auction, we'll have it posted online, and it's still going on with that. But that will be one problem, and the other one, it will be just direct donations from people who want to support the organization. So the silent auction will be like a side thing, and the main event will be just talking about us, and we'll have people and staff talking about experiences, and hopefully we're trying to have a couple of workers talking about their experience and how us has been part of their life too. So that's the idea with the fundraising event, showing the stories of the work that we're doing basically.
And the items that you're auctioning are donated from the community? What kind of items are we talking about?
Yeah, a couple of them. We have quite a few posters from an organization called Just Seat, and they have social issues posters and historical posters that are super cool. You'll see them more likely this week posted on the social media, the Facebook event. And we have a couple of earrings from one of the small jewelry here in Portland. We have one night at the Cannon Beach Hotel.
So if people want to find out more information, I understand that they can go to your website or to your Facebook. That's Portland Voz, that's VOZ.org, right?
Yes. If you go to the website, right there in the homepage, there is a link, and it talks about the event and then support, and from there you get all the information, what we are about, and what the event is going to be talking about. So, and right there you can... One of the things that you can support is just buying the plan in the past was to have the annual dinner when you buy a ticket to be part of the event, but in this case you can still buy a ticket, and that will be your way to support the organization. And you can do that through our website online, so contactless, so, and then just be there online the day of to support the work we're doing.
That's great. And of course, people can always call Portland Voz at 503-234-2043, yes, either to donate, yes, or to hire a worker for a day or a week or whatever is needed. Again, I've been speaking with Marvin Pena, who is with Portland Voz, the Workers' Rights and Education Center located there on Southeast or Northeast Martin Luther King Boulevard, just south of I-84. If you are coming up the Martin Luther King Boulevard, you'll see Portland Voz Center on the right-hand side.
Yep. Thank you very much for having me and, giving me the opportunity to spread the word. And hopefully I'll see you, all you listeners, the day of the event again, September 12th. And Facebook Live. So thank you very much, Jenka.
All right. Thanks, Marvin. This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, prisoners in solitary confinement at a correctional facility in eastern Oregon have gone on a hunger strike. Severe fires in California continue to endanger residents. And in international news, flooding in China has forced over 100,000 people to evacuate. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 19, 2020. I'm Nat Moon. The Oregon Health Authority reported 203 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday, bringing the state's total up to 23,870 cases. No deaths were reported on Monday, but Oregon health officials reported 11 COVID-19 deaths on Tuesday, bringing the state's death toll to 408 people. Nationally, over 43,000 new COVID-19 cases were reported yesterday, and at least 1,350 people died yesterday from the virus. As of this afternoon, over 5.5 million people have had the virus in the United States, and at least 172,000 people have died. Worldwide, 22 million people have been infected, and over 780,000 people have died. Protests in Portland against police brutality and systemic racism continued for the 83rd consecutive night on Tuesday. Demonstrators have gathered and held events for nearly 3 months following the murder of George Floyd by police in May. On Tuesday night, a group of about 200 people marched to the Multnomah County building in southeast Portland. A small number of protesters broke windows and set a fire inside the building. Police declared a riot and responded to the property damage with aggressive physical force. One video by Twitter user John the Lefty shows an individual appearing to be wearing a press badge get attacked by a police officer who uses his baton to hit the individual in the face. Two people were arrested. In the past 83 nights of demonstrations, police have often responded forcefully to protesters and declared the assemblies unlawful, physically assaulting numerous people, making unnecessarily aggressive arrests, and indiscriminately deploying crowd control munitions. In related news, Portland's independent police oversight body has launched an investigation into more than 40 complaints related to protest policing since June. A group of prisoners in solitary confinement at the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution went on a hunger strike on Monday. The prison, located in Pendleton, Oregon, is home to the single largest outbreak of COVID-19 at any workplace or prison in the state. The group is demanding the transfer of Stephen Corbett, a prisoner with Crohn's disease who has been having seizures that cause him to fall and culminate in what witnesses say are his organs coming out of his body into his colostomy bag. Nurses in the facility assert that he is, quote, faking it. A prisoner at Snake River Correctional Institution recently died from COVID-19 on August 12th. In addition to demanding the immediate transfer of Corbett to a hospital, the prisoners are also demanding they be allowed the purchase of basic hygiene and cleaning supplies. Current policy allows for one bar of soap and one box of baking soda per prisoner per month. They are also demanding the immediate release of everyone who has been placed in solitary for nonviolent offenses and are demanding one call a week for all people in solitary confinement. The prison's policy currently does not let prisoners make a phone call from solitary until they've been there for 30 days. Oregon Employment Department Acting Director David Gerstenfeld held a press conference today to share updates on the status of unemployment claims in the state. Gerstenfeld said claims have dropped in the last month, but are still three times higher than they were in March. There are reportedly only about 1,400 claims left for the office to process, and he said the department has paid out almost $4 billion so far from various assistance programs. Gerstenfeld urged people to not lose hope, saying, quote, please do continue to file weekly claims. If you've been waiting, please reach out. He said they are trying to prioritize people who have been waiting the longest. Night two of the Democratic National Convention saw Joe Biden officially nominated for president. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
The great state of Texas cast 98 votes for Bernie Sanders and 161 votes for our next president, Joe Biden.
Ohio cast 20 votes for Senator Bernie Sanders and 134 votes for the next president, Joe Biden.
Puerto Rico emite 5 votos para Bernie Sanders y 53 votos para Joe Biden.
Delegations from all 57 states and territories videoed in for the roll call, and Democratic National Convention Chair Benny Thompson, congressman from Mississippi, made it final.
I'm pleased to announce that Vice President Joe Biden has officially been nominated by the Democratic Party.
Biden's wife, Dr. Jill Biden, taught English at a community college while serving as second lady in the Obama administration. Earlier in her career, she taught at Brandywine High School in Delaware. From her former classroom, she described her husband's faith as, quote, unshakable. She met Joe Biden after the tragic death of his first wife and daughter.
How do you make a broken family whole? The same way you make a nation whole. With love and understanding, and with small acts of kindness.
Former Presidents Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton spoke, as well as former Secretaries of State from both parties, Democrat John Kerry and Colin Powell, a Republican. Instead of the usual rousing keynote address, the kind that boosted Barack Obama's career in 2004, there was a video montage of 17 of the party's, quote, rising stars. Notably, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the youngest woman in Congress, was not included. She did give the official nominating speech for former candidate Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders supports Biden, but kept his name in the running so his delegates could influence the Democrats' party platform. Ocasio-Cortez described their goals.
Mass people's movement working to establish 21st century social, economic, and human rights, including guaranteed health care, higher education, living wages, and labor rights.
Alaska, Wyoming, and Florida all had primaries yesterday. The Florida Rights Restoration Coalition led the campaign for a 2018 ballot initiative to enfranchise 1.4 million Floridians with past felony convictions. Desmond Mead, the group's executive director, described his experience voting for the first time in 30 years to Progressive Business Group Social Venture Circle.
I walked in there and I channeled the spirit of my ancestors and of the returning citizens. I channeled the spirit of the love that got me to this point. By passing Amendment 4.
All three states, some were voting by mail and relatively smooth operations. Florida is the one state where President Trump has endorsed mail-in voting and mailed in his own ballot. In response to public outcry, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy postponed controversial changes to postal operations until after the November election. But critics call for reversing some that have already begun, like removing sorting machines and collection boxes. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
The Democratic National Convention included a meeting of the Native American Caucus, where speakers talked about youth empowerment and the importance of Native representation in office. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Democratic National Convention Day 2 included a meeting of the Native American Caucus. Speakers talked about the importance of voting in the general election, youth empowerment, and having Native American representation in office. Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota Peggy Flanagan touched on some of the Native issues being addressed in her state, including missing and murdered Indigenous people and tribal-state relationship training. She says it's important to also have allies in office all the way up to the White House who respect treaty rights and tribal sovereignty.
To ensure that we are at the table, that we are being consulted, and that we are no longer taken for granted or simply seen as obstacles, as I would argue that is how we're treated under the Trump administration. There's an incredible opportunity here to ensure that Native people, that our votes are counted, that we turn out. And, you know, for a long time, we talked a lot about, Native folks are registering and turning out and impacting elections. And that is true. And we will do it again. But we also know that Native people are stepping up and running for political office in numbers and amounts that we have never seen.
Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke about supporting Indian country issues and working with Congresswoman Deb Haaland on improving health care. Warren urged Native voters to support Joe Biden for president.
As I've said about Joe, he will always tell you where he stands. Well, he has told us where he stands. He stands with Indian country. So Deb and I are continuing our work on our legislation to honor America's promises to the tribal nations. And we're going to keep pushing for a nation-to-nation relationship between tribal nations and the federal government. We will stay in this fight. And with Joe Biden in the White House, and a Democratic majority in the House and the Senate, we're going to have an opening unlike any in modern history.
Democrats officially nominated Biden as their nominee for president Tuesday night. The virtual roll call from each state nominating Biden featured four Indigenous people, from Alaska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and New Mexico. The night also included mentions of indigenous lands in Wisconsin, which is hosting the DNC, and a unique keynote address from 17 leaders across the country, from mayors to state lawmakers and Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez. Nez took to social media Tuesday night talking about his DNC remarks and urging Navajo citizens to vote.
If you don't vote, don't complain. That's the simplest thing I could say, because you have an opportunity to make change happen. You know, I'm not going to be in this position forever. There's going to be somebody behind me, younger leaders that are coming up. You know, this keynote address was given to only 17 people throughout this country. 17 people in the Navajo Nation was represented.
The convention continues Wednesday with caucus meetings. Biden will deliver his acceptance speech on Thursday. The Cherokee Nation welcomed two bison this week from Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming to its herd in northeast Oklahoma. The bison are from a partnership with the Intertribal Buffalo Council. The Cherokee Nation is one of 16 tribes across the country to receive bison from Yellowstone. The tribe's been growing its bison herd the last 5 years, managing a ranch with about 180 bison. The tribe's working on preservation efforts and seeking economic opportunities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
On Tuesday, California Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency in response to wildfires blazing across the state. 10,000 strikes of lightning have caused an alarming number of independent fires to spring up across the state. The governor had already declared a state of emergency due to the extreme heat. The new order is intended to provide additional help for those affected by the fires. The largest fire, called the Lightning Complex, has burned over 85,000 acres in five Northern California counties and is only 5% contained. Another group of lightning-adjacent fires in Napa and Sonoma counties has consumed over 46,000 acres with zero containment. Fires are also being fought near Vacaville, north of Sacramento, along the coast north of Santa Cruz,